You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 8th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pence flies, but Harris soars past him in post-debate polls. I'm genuinely sorry for that, folks. Meanwhile, Trump bails on the next debate, and his campaign is supposedly hitting the road again, but not before he blames Gold Star families for his COVID. White House plans to impose more unilateral sanctions on Iran in defiance of our European allies, and particularly their humanitarian concerns. After Trump's tweet storm, Pelosi and the White House are back to negotiating the economic relief so desperately needed by the American public. A judge orders Twitter to unmask the FBI impersonator who launched the Seth Rich conspiracy. And in an unlikely editorial, the New England Journal of Medicine urges Trump's ouster. And today, the Justice Department consent decree, whose expiration Trump may be counting on. World Bank warns that COVID may push 150 million people into extreme poverty around the world. And a House committee, after a 16-month long process, calls for sweeping changes to antitrust law. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We are less than 4 weeks away from the day in which we call Election Day. Hopefully most of you know by now that because of mail-in ballots, the counting process could last days. We may not have an answer to who is the president of the United States for days after November 3rd, even weeks. And we will talk about some of those reasons as to why. But with all that said, you should know there is a tremendous amount of early voting going on right now as we speak. The ELECT project, U.S. Elections Project, I should say, at electproject.github, has a breakdown of the early vote as a share of the 2016, of the total 2016 vote. In South Dakota, the early vote at this point, we are still, again, 3+ weeks out from the actual election day, where everything needs to be postmarked by that day. In some instances, even before then, I think, but certainly you should get your votes in. But in South Dakota, it is 22.8% of early votes are in as a percentage of the 2016 vote. That's pretty stunning. In Virginia, that number is almost 21%. In Wisconsin, almost 21%. In Wyoming, almost 15%. Vermont, 14%. Michigan, 13%. North Dakota, 12%. New Jersey, 12%. Florida, 12%. 12.3%. And Minnesota, 11.3%. And that's from last Friday. So it's pretty stunning numbers. People are obviously getting out there and voting early. I think we had some footage the other day from a line around the block. Was that in Ohio, Brendan?
That was Columbus, Ohio, yeah.
And I mean, people were lined up around the block for early voting. It is, if you are capable of doing so, and obviously officials are trying to make it as safe as possible. In many cases, people say that it's safer than actually going to a supermarket. I don't know how you assess that, except for in some instances, many people are waiting outside as opposed to milling around inside. But if you are capable of doing it, it is highly recommended. Meanwhile, last night there was a vice presidential debate. The polling following the debate. I mean, the interesting thing that I'm finding is that in past years, I have assessed debates based on the substance that is exchanged. But after the presidential debate, the first one, and maybe it appears now, possibly the last one, it's unclear. There was absolutely no substance, as far as I could tell, and it largely irrelevant at this point, right? I mean, if you don't have I think for the people who tune into debates who are interested in substance, it should be pretty clear the primary differences between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Joe Biden is, at the very least, not Donald Trump. And every issue ranging from the Supreme Court to the total abdication, I mean, it's probably worse than abdication of responsibility in terms of the pandemic. They have been a net negative, this administration, in terms of dealing with this pandemic. You don't have to believe me. The New England Journal of Medicine, which, as far as I know, does not generally issue any type of editorials relative to elections. It is a 202-year-old medical journal. The journal did not endorse Joe Biden. It did not mention Donald Trump by name. But this is the key graph here. Our leaders have largely claimed immunity for their actions. This is in regards to the federal government's weak and inappropriate policies. But this election gives us the power to render judgment. Reasonable people will certainly disagree about the many political positions taken by candidates, but truth is neither liberal nor conservative. When it comes to the response to the largest public health crisis of our time, our current political leaders have demonstrated that they are dangerously incompetent. We should not abet them and enable the deaths of thousands more Americans by allowing them to keep their jobs. The editor-in-chief said, we rarely publish editorials signed by all the editors, but they did so this time. And so, I mean, that in and of itself, one would think would provide enough substance. And last night, it's hard to say that there was any more, significant. I don't know that there was any specifics about any policies, frankly. I think we heard a little bit about Joe Biden's pledge to not raise taxes on anybody making less than $400,000. And I honestly don't know that I could point to another sort of specific policy that was even remotely discussed at that point. Nevertheless, people tune into these debates and they make assessments based on performances. We had another situation where the moderator seemed completely incapable of maintaining the rules that they explicitly set out at the beginning of the debate. Mike Pence kept running over on time, so ultimately Kamala Harris was given other time, but it was Mike Pence answered, it appeared to me, none of the difficult questions that were posed to him. I mean, even remotely difficult questions. I think there was literally four or five times where he explicitly ignored the question. Almost said, like, I'm not going to answer that one, but I've got another one I would like to answer. Kamala Harris had one moment, I would say, like that, where they wanted to key in on the question of court packing. And I, as I said in the debate wrap-up, we did a live stream last night. In the debate wrap-up, that was, what do you call it, dipped in tequila. The wrap up. One of the things I think that Kamala Harris could have done, and it was, you know, obviously this is a there are challenges for a woman, I think, in a debate in our political sphere. There's challenges for a black woman in the context of our debates, or even just broadly speaking in our political sphere. You're seeing a lot of a commentary on the right that Kamala Harris's smile was too smug, I guess, which is almost hitting the, you know, it's almost about as ham-fisted as you could get. But I think she would have been well served to point out to the audience and to Pence that he's not answering the questions. With all that said, she won the debate, if there is a way to assess this, in terms of the instant polls of registered voters who watched. 6 in 10, according to a CNN instant poll, said Harris won. 38% said Pence won. In interviews conducted before the debate, 61% of those same voters said they expected Harris to win. 36% thought Pence would. There was a very big gender gap, which, and while both genders thought that Harris won, I mean, men split 48% Harris, 46% Pence, it was 69% to 30%. For women. And I think the Democrats have to feel pretty good about that. Women really drove the 2018 midterm like slaughter, essentially, that took place and led to one of the biggest Democratic vote tally wins on an off-year election in decades. So Kamala Harris, I think, comes out of that looking pretty good. And we have the opportunity to look at this footage from the debate. And this is, I would say, this is getting the most attention. I would say there's basically two sort of non, even remotely substantive things that have come out of the debate from last night that are getting probably the most amount of attention. Pence not answering any of the questions. That's been a big part of it. Pence going over time and the moderator saying, thank you, Vice President, over and over and over again. And Kamala Harris, I think, you know, like I said, had a better second half than she did first half. But really, at the end of the day, the genuine winner, the biggest winner of the debate was the fly that took the opportunity to land on Mike Pence and stay there for apparently 2 minutes. Is this video that you have, Brendan?
Yes, this is a 2 minute close up of Mike Pence.
Well, forehead. I don't want to play it for 2 minutes, but for a moment. I wonder, let this roll and let's see what we got here.
To the men and women who serve in law enforcement, wow. I want everyone to know who puts on the uniform of law enforcement every day. And President Trump and I stand with you. And it is remarkable that when Senator Tim Scott tried to pass the police reform bill.
Yeah, let me just be clear. It's not the fly talking, right? That's Pence talking.
Yeah. And then you filibustered Senator Tim Scott's bill on the Senate floor that would have provided new accountability, new resources. But we don't have to choose between supporting law enforcement.
All right, we can't watch that for the full 2 minutes, but I think people get the idea. The big winner is the fly. And then
it's like one of those robot bulls in a bar. Kind of that's what the fly was doing to Pence's head there.
Riding the vice president. And then also a lot of people making a big deal about Mike Pence. Either he had one eye that was watering or I don't know. That seemed to garner a lot of attention. I mean, you know, much of this is theater in this instance. But I thought Harris held her own with Pence in many respects. I don't think it's going to change the outcome of the election. And in that sense, it is a win for the Democrats because Joe Biden has a significant lead in the polls. Now, there are other issues with the election. We will talk about that in a moment. But I think the Democrats got what they wanted out of last night. And Mike Pence probably did, too. He's thinking about 2024. Today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Counseling. It's giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Look, a lot of people trying to go see therapists, obviously wanting to do it remote. There's a lot of therapists who have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks, sometimes month to see one. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and they do so so that you are talking to those people, that therapist, within 24 hours. Obviously, very stressful time for people. I've suggested BetterHelp to a couple of people. It's a great way, particularly if you've never been involved in therapy. It's a great way to try it out. With BetterHelp, once they connect you with a therapist, if you don't feel like it's a good fit, you can switch at any time to a new one. So you can try someone for a couple of sessions. If it doesn't work out, very easy to switch to a new one. There's no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists all over the country. Many of these therapists will have specialties that maybe you cannot find in your local area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable and therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance for BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/majority report. Okay, so in the wake of the debate last night, or I should say, prior to the debate last night, Donald Trump released what appeared to be an infomercial for the company Regeneron. We'll play a clip of that in a moment. And it was his pitch that he is feeling great. Sometime after the debate last night, I think it was, or maybe it was just before the debate, the sponsors of the next presidential debate, which was scheduled to be about a week from now, said that this will be remote because, as you will recall, at the last debate, it appears that Donald Trump may have already been infected with COVID. And there is probably an absence of trust in the White House ability to show up without a caravan of infected people. And so the plan was do this remote. Donald Trump has backed out of that. But let's just go through this. This is Donald Trump last night, prior to the debate. It was a 4.5 minute long infomercial or so for various pharmaceuticals and perhaps some type of tanning spray. I don't think he explicitly mentioned the tanning spray, but you be the judge. Here is just about 30 seconds of that.
Have these drugs, Eli Lilly and the others that are so good, but they are, in my opinion, remember this, they're going to say that they're therapeutic, and I guess they are therapeutic. Some people don't know how to define therapeutic. I view it different. It's a cure. For me, I walked in, I didn't feel good. A short 24 hours later, I was feeling great. I wanted to get out of the hospital. And that's what I want for everybody. I want everybody to be given the same treatment as your president. Because I feel great. I feel like perfect. So I think this was a blessing from God that I caught it. This was a blessing in disguise. I caught it. I heard about this drug. I said, let me take it. It was my suggestion. I said, let me take it. And it was incredible the way it worked. Incredible. And I think if I didn't catch it, we'd be looking at that like a number of other drugs. But it really did a fantastic job. I want to get for you what I got, and I'm going to make it free. You're not going to pay for it. It wasn't your fault that this happened. It was China's fault.
I guess it's better than insisting that Mexico is going to pay for it. It's hard to know how much this drug from Regeneron will cost. It has only been administered, at least according to the reporting, to about 10 people. It's a very experimental drug. And there have been at least assessments that the company stands to make $1 billion from it. So Donald Trump there calling it a cure when, of course, it is not a cure. But if it were a cure, that would mean that Donald Trump no longer has the coronavirus. And surely they must be testing him, right? I mean, because you'd want to see if he's still infected, and you'd want to see if he's still contagious. Well, here is Mark Meadows yesterday on Fox News discussing that very issue.
And there are a lot of things we still don't know. We're listening to the physicians and all the statements they put out, but we don't know when his last negative test was. Will we?
Well, we don't normally get into the testing protocol for the president. Obviously, the doctor has already spoken about that it was a positive test on last Thursday evening when he was confirmed to have the coronavirus. And obviously, the doctor here, the White House doctor, kicked into gear with making sure that he was protected and had the medical treatment that was proper. I can tell you that from our standpoint, I think the doctor put out today, that there were no antibodies with the amount of review that was done that particular night, which would indicate that we caught it very, very early. And so we're just very thankful that he's where he's at. And
wait, what?
Wow.
Well, first off, what Mark Meadows is not saying is that the president has tested negative for COVID. Now, is there any human being alive who believes that if they had tested the president and it came back negative, that Mark Meadows would not be talking about that? It's conceivable they're not testing the president because maybe the president doesn't want to be tested. It's conceivable they've tested him and he's come back positive and they don't want to talk about that. But it is inconceivable that the president has tested negative and they wouldn't tell us. It also seems to be that he's saying that the president doesn't have any antibodies. Now, initially, didn't we hear that the president did have antibodies? I don't know. We're not getting much transparency from the White House. So one can understand why they decided to not have a in real life debate, because I don't know. I mean, like, even if you're like organizing this thing or you're working, you know, with the production company or whatever, I mean, could you honestly, would you feel good about saying, like, who wants the debate assignment here? I mean, you honestly would have to take volunteers. It's like, here is Donald Trump this morning on Fox Business News with Maria Bartiromo explaining why he's not going to do a virtual debate. Now, let's hear his explanation first, and then I will give you my speculation as to why.
Thank you so much for being here. First question is, how are you feeling? How is the First Lady feeling this morning?
She's feeling good. I'm feeling good, really good. I think perfect, and we're ready to go. I'm ready to go, except the quarantine situation that you have for a little while after you get tested or whatever the procedure is. But I'm ready to do, and I'm looking forward to doing the rallies. I heard that the commission a little while ago changed the debate style, and that's not acceptable to us. I beat him easily in the first debate, according to the polls that I've seen, but I beat him easily. I felt I beat him easily. I think he felt.
Can somebody find me a poll that says that he won? Did they just poll like in the White House? I didn't see any polls that said he won. Are they showing him? Are they showing him?
All the non-fake news polls had me winning.
I mean, honestly, maybe they just polled like people in the White House and showed him that one. But nevertheless, continue.
The two, he wouldn't answer any questions, and he had the protection of Chris Wallace all night long. It was just, I thought Chris Wallace was a disaster. But I beat him in the first debate. At the second debate, we have a never-Trumper as a host, but that's okay because I beat him in the second debate also. And but I'm not going to do a virtual debate.
So, Mr. President, you're not going to do it because the CPD, the Commission on Presidential Debates, announcing this morning that the second presidential debate will be virtual. Are you saying you're not going to participate?
No, I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate. That's not what debating's all about. You sit behind a computer and do a debate. It's ridiculous. And then they cut you off whenever they want. I have a host who I always thought was a nice guy, but I see he's a never-Trumper. You know, came out that he's a never-Trumper. We do have some of them, Maria, believe it or not, because they don't like to win. I'm not doing a virtual debate. They didn't even tell us about the debate, Maria.
So Donald Trump decides he's not going to do the debate, and he basically laid it out for you as to why, is because they'd actually make him follow the rules. I mean, for Donald Trump, like, did he say anything in the last debate? His whole debate was just simply to interrupt Joe Biden. And so I think in this instance, he's concerned he couldn't do that. I mean, when you're sitting in front of a computer and you're talking, as opposed to there being a in real life dynamic between people, people tend to pay more attention to what you're saying. I don't think he wants that. I think that's a real concern. It's going to be interesting to see how this is plays in the press. I mean, this is him being afraid of facing Joe Biden in a debate format in which the only thing that he can control is his expression of why he should be elected president or reelected president. And I think he's afraid he can't do it. I mean, I can understand why Joe Biden might be a little bit concerned about catching COVID from the guy. His own chief of staff is on Fox News today and cannot answer the question, has he had a negative test? They don't want to answer when the last negative test he had before he was found positive was. And they don't want to answer if he's had a negative test as of today. Of course, I wouldn't go near him. No, I don't know if I would go near him anyways. But Donald Trump will not be participating in that debate. And so a big reason is I think he's just simply afraid of facing Joe Biden there. I mean, the problem that the Trump campaign has had, and I think they're more or less, I mean, I don't know what their strategy is at this point, at least from strategy, at least in terms of winning the election with votes. They started out by saying Sleepy Joe is afraid to debate me. And now Donald Trump is refusing to debate because he doesn't have the opportunity to talk over Biden, that he's actually just going to actually have to present his case to be reelected. I think they're in a very, very weak position here, at least if their agenda is to rack up more votes against Joe Biden. But they probably have a plan B. And we've seen the outlines of this for weeks and in many respects, months. I mean, frankly, you go back to the reason why Donald Trump was impeached to see what one of their plan Bs was. I mean, I don't know what the actual lettering would have been. Maybe it was their plan A. It was their plan 1A or A1B. And that was, of course, to get to create a scandal around Hunter Biden and Burisma. That fell apart largely because of the impeachment. The next big push from the Trump administration has been in the Trump campaign, and I don't know that there's really any difference, has been this argument that mail-in ballots are illegitimate. Last night at the debate, Mike Pence was asked about peaceful transition of power. This is a gimme, folks. This is one where you just simply say, of course. And I mean, supposedly when Donald Trump said, I'm not so sure about it, it was sort of like a half in jest. But here's Mike Pence avoiding the question.
President Trump has several times refused to commit himself to a peaceful transfer of power after the election. If Vice President Biden is declared the winner and President Trump refuses to accept a peaceful transfer of power, what would be your role and responsibility as vice president? What would you personally do? You have 2 minutes.
Well, Susan, first and foremost, I think we're going to win this election. Because while Joe Biden and Kamala Harris rattle off a long litany of the establishment in Washington, D.C., an establishment that Joe Biden's been a part of for 47 years, President Donald Trump has launched a movement of everyday Americans from every walk of life. And I have every confidence that those same Americans that delivered that historic victory in 2016, they see this president's record where we rebuild our military. We revived our economy through tax cuts and rolling back regulation, fighting for fair trade, unleashing American energy. We appointed conservatives to our federal courts at every level. And we stood with the men and women of law enforcement every single day. And I think that movement of Americans has only grown stronger in the last 4 years. But when you talk about accepting the outcome of the election, I must tell you, Senator, your party has spent the last 3.5 years trying to overturn the results of the last election. It's amazing. When Joe Biden was vice president of the United States, the FBI actually spied on President Trump and my campaign. I mean, there were documents released this week that the CIA actually made a referral to the FBI documenting that those allegations were coming from the Hillary Clinton campaign. And, of course, we've all seen the avalanche, what you put the country through for the better part of 3 years until it was found that there was no obstruction, no collusion, case closed.
So he wouldn't answer the question. And I suspect part of that is, I mean, look, him saying it one way or another is not going to change their behavior. But I think the idea is that they want to maintain a lot of confusion about this election. And one of the ways that they're going to do it is by sort of delegitimizing the entire process. And so they are arguing, the implicit argument that Mike Pence makes when he refuses to say that we will leave peacefully if Joe Biden is declared the winner, is that that declaration of Joe Biden being declared the winner is illegitimate on arrival. That is the implicit argument that they're making. And there's a whole host of things that are happening. It feels like almost every day that they're small things that are aimed towards creating a certain amount of, or I should say, uncertainty around the entire electoral process. One of the things that people should be aware of is that starting in 1982, the Republican Party had a consent decree that they signed with the Department of Justice barring the Republican Party as a national entity from any type of poll watching. The consent decree came as a function of what took place in New Jersey in 1981. There was an off-year election for state and municipal offices, and there were groups of men, some of whom were elected, or at least one was an elected official. Others were apparently off-duty police officers who called themselves the National Ballot Security Task Force. And they had armbands saying this. They were supposedly on the lookout for people casting fraudulent ballots. So all of this talk you've heard in this election about fraudulent voting from the Republicans, all the talk you heard in 2016 from the Republicans regarding fraudulent elections, all the talk we heard from the Bush administration. People forget that there were U.S. attorneys who were fired across the country because they would not, in the lead up to the 2004 election, they would not find voter fraud that could be prosecuted as a way of intimidating people from getting to the ballots. This is a longstanding Republican tactic, so much so that in 1982, when this band of white marauders, essentially, some of them apparently armed, showed up at the polls. They were asking for people's voter registration cards. They were telling them that they needed them or their ballot would be illegal. Democratic leaders at the time went to in front of a judge. And apparently the race was very, very close in New Jersey, or one of the races. I think it was the governor's race at the time. And what ultimately happened was, in a court case that took place, I believe, in New Jersey, but it was a federal court, I believe. There was 80 people willing to testify to experiencing or witnessing intimidation. And this was brought against this was a lawsuit brought against the Republican National Committee. The argument was that this tax force targeted Black and Latino voters, and therefore was a violation of the Voting Rights Act. The case was settled between the Republican National Committee and the Department of Justice, and they signed a consent decree, which basically says, we don't admit any guilt, but we agree not to participate in this type of activity for X amount of years. Donald Trump had to sign one at one point for keeping Black people out of his apartment buildings back in the 70s. In fact, I think he had to sign two. But that consent decree sunsetted in December of 2017. There was a court case in January of 2018 where Democrats attempted to extend the consent decree. They failed because there was no evidence that the Republican National Committee had engaged in any other type of voter suppression since then. In other words, they hadn't violated the consent decree and it sunsetted. And so this is the first nationwide election where the Republican Party is allowed to deploy poll watchers to the polls across the country. Now, I don't imagine that they're going to do it across the country, but it's very likely that they're going to do it in various localities, like states like Pennsylvania, let's say, or Wisconsin, or Michigan. And just yesterday, apparently, or an email that was sent, I guess, by Friday of last week, ProPublica reports that the DOJ has changed its policy on voting-related crimes. According to ProPublica, the DOJ policy, which says that in the event that there are any voting-related crimes, you, as a Department of Justice prosecutor, cannot make any public announcement about the ongoing investigations that are close to an election. And you also cannot take any public steps like an arrest or a raid before a vote is finalized in the weeks before an election, because the publicity could impact the outcome of the race. This is one of the reasons why people were so upset about the Comey letter in 2016. It was a complete violation of DOJ policy. But according to ProPublica, and according to an email sent on Friday by an official in the public integrity section in Washington, if a U.S. attorney's office now suspects election fraud that involves postal workers or military employees, this is, recall the supposed scandal from a couple of weeks ago where Bill Barr was involved in the finding of 8 ballots in an office in Pennsylvania. Federal investigators will be allowed to take public investigative steps before the polls close, even if those actions risk affecting the outcome of the election. And no one's quite sure what to make of this, but the loosening of this policy that has been in place for 40 years has got people a little bit concerned. The new policy carve-out, this is according to Vanita Gupta. He was the former head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division under President Obama. It may be creating a predicate for the Justice Department to make inflated announcements about mail-in vote fraud and the like in the run-up to the election. Now, it's possible it's not, and it's possible it's just a justification for what they did regarding those ballots in Pennsylvania. But we have Donald Trump calling for poll watchers who presumably are going to find some problems, who presumably are then going to go to the U.S. attorney in specific states, who then can make public pronouncements in the run-up to the polls. And this is happening concurrently with courts around the country, in some instances of the Supreme Court, making it harder for people to vote. I mean, there's just a multi-pronged effort to disenfranchise people or to create obstacles to people voting in this election. And that seems to be increasingly, you know, with Donald Trump refusing to go into a debate when he's clearly behind in the polls. Increasingly, that seems to be they're moving up into their sort of like first order strategy. And if you find that disturbing, you should. It's disturbing. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be back in just a moment. So we should tell you that the despite the fact that Donald Trump tweeted the other day that he was calling off any type of negotiations regarding any COVID relief, economic relief, it is reported that, and I guess in part Donald Trump said this maybe on some interview this morning, but it is reported that Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin have begun negotiating over a bill to rescue the airlines. We have United and American Airlines furloughed more than 30,000 workers last week. We have more than 850,000 Americans who were applying filing a new unemployment claims. That was last week. This week's numbers will be in shortly. And no support for cities and states. Moody's downgraded New York City the other day. And this is the thing. It's always the airlines. That's where they end up breaking. New York Times just reporting, apparently, that Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she wouldn't agree to a standalone aid package for airlines unless the White House agreed to a broader stimulus plan. It's the airlines. You'll recall that when there was a government shutdown orchestrated by the Republicans, it wasn't until the flight attendants union said, we're not going to get on these planes because they're not safe because of the government shutdown and how it was impacting air traffic controllers. And when the flight attendants made that announcement, it took literally hours before Mitch McConnell decided that they could reopen the government. When the airlines start to have problems, when air travel in this country gets diminished, that's when the Republicans, at the very least, start to hear it. Because air travel is incredibly important to corporate America and to very wealthy people. And this is Pelosi realizing that there is one leverage point, and that is the airlines. Donald Trump wants to rescue the airlines and then basically cut another $1,200 check to everybody. That is necessary but insufficient. We need support for cities. We need support for states. We need support for testing around the country. And we need more than just a one-off $1,200 stimulus check. We need expanded unemployment insurance. We should be paying, as we discussed the other day with Professor Wolf, we should be paying American workers to stay home so that we can get to a point where things like schools can open up because community spread has diminished. But we're not doing that. And hopefully Pelosi can hold the line. Donald Trump tweeting out in the middle of the night the other night that he was shutting down negotiations did not help the Republicans. And hopefully the Democrats can leverage that, and it will take some of the pressure off their frontline seats, as they call them, those Democrats elected in purplish or even reddish districts. Lastly, before we go today, I want to just draw your attention to something that is undoubtedly not going to be reported much by broadcast media. New York Times reports on this, and there's a great piece in the American Prospect by David Dayan about it. But this is very important because in the event that Joe Biden wins, this is going to be one of the major Democratic initiatives coming out of the House. And it is in about 450 pages of a report that was presented by the House Judiciary Committee's leadership. It took 16 months of investigations to write. It involves specifically Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. But the principles that are discussed in this report and the solutions offered are going to have implications for not just the tech sector, but for every sector. And it involves antitrust. The report has found that those companies in particular, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, had abused their dominant positions. They have set and often dictated prices and rules for commerce. They have done it for search and advertising and social networking and publishing. They have become, quote, the kinds of monopolies we last saw in the era of oil barons and railroad tycoons. We've talked a lot about antitrust on this program, and it is going to be, in the event that Joe Biden wins, one of the biggest, I think, fights that the Democrats are going to wage. And it's going to be interesting to see, when you see this concerted effort coming out of the House, how the Biden administration will react. But largely, what they are proposing is all actions to be taken by Congress. The report cites 10 specific Supreme Court and other court decisions that should be overruled and overruled by Congress by rewriting and clarifying the statutory intent of existing antitrust laws. The short story of this is during the Reagan era, our antitrust regime was essentially reinterpreted. Largely, this was the work of Robert Bork, where we used to have an antitrust regime that basically said monopolies are bad because A, it hurts consumers in terms of price, but it also hurts consumers in other ways, in terms of choice, in terms of quality. And it also hurts democracy and citizens insofar as it makes these companies too powerful and they get to shape not just commerce in an inappropriate way. They get to destroy other companies in an inappropriate way, but they have too much power over our democracy in policy, generally speaking. And that was the antitrust regime that we had in this country from the early 1900s through to the 1980s. And under Ronald Reagan, that was changed to simply a test, is it a monopoly? Do consumers get cheaper prices? And if consumers get cheaper prices, then it is not a destructive monopoly. This is a slight oversimplification, but that's basically what it came down to. And this 16-month investigation and the 449-page report by the House Judiciary Committee basically says we need to revert to the earlier perspective we had on what constituted monopoly, because quality is down of products, choice is down. You have companies like Facebook gobbling up what they said is basically real estate. They're buying competitors. They're knocking them out of business. As David Dayan says, they are using their position as gatekeeper in their particular markets, social media, search, e-commerce, cloud computing, smartphone operating systems, and app distribution, voice assistants, and more to maintain market power, crush and exploit rivals, make partners who rely on their services subservient. This is a problem in many, many different industries. It happens in agriculture, where buyers maintain what is known as a monopsony, and they force farms to operate in ways that just simply make it cheaper for them to buy. We see it in the context of all sorts. We see it in the context of airlines and others. Places like Google and Amazon have used restrictive contracts. Amazon, they have contracts which make their products within their marketplace, make them the default settings. They hurt other businesses. You have Apple 99% of all mobile browsers come from companies who make the smartphone operating systems. To get onto the Apple Store, you've got to pay a 30% VIG, and it's virtually impossible to release a – well, it's almost – it's basically impossible to release an Apple app unless you give Apple a 30% kickback. And as David Dayan writes, another thing that's palpable, while less noticed, and he says this is also in the report, is this incumbent dominance makes everything just a little bit worse. The report describes the consequence of absence of competition being that, quote, quality has deteriorated over time through degraded privacy protections, less relevant search results, and the rise of misinformation and counterfeits, and the decline of trust in what we read. As Dayan says, monopolies are bad because they make things demonstrably worse. We'll be talking more about this antitrust stuff, I have a feeling, in the months to come, particularly in the event if Joe Biden prevails. But again, if you have the opportunity, go out and vote. Early voting is happening across the country. Check your local listings for that. We will be back tomorrow. Stay safe, and we'll see you then. All right. In the meantime, today we're going to do the fun half. The crew is going to be back. I should just say that I guess basically since August, maybe it was late July, we've been playing best ofs of some interviews that Michael did on this program. There are obviously, you can search in our YouTube for Michael shows, and obviously check out the Michael Brooks show on YouTube. Matt and Griscom and Leisha have been continuing on with that program, but you also have the ability to go back and see some of the interviews that Michael Brooks did over the past couple of years. Going forward, we're going to be doing the shows basically like this. I'll be doing the first hour, and then the crew will be here. New Matt, old Matt, I guess timeless Jamie, and futuristic Brendan. Have I hit every possible temporal sphere? So stick around for that. The fun half will be coming up in a minute. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, check out justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, co-op in Madison. Great movement supporters. And they also make great coffee, and you get 10% off when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. And we have a Majority Report blend, so you can check that out. Also, the AM Quickie, it's getting really big. People are talking about it all over the place. You can sign up for that at amquickie.com. Check it out. 6-7 minutes of headlines in your podcast server every day, all free. You can check that out. Also, Nomi's show today. Do we know what it is? I don't know who's on today, but I imagine they're going to do some debate roundup. And you can find that at youtube.com, the Nomiki show. And Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Hey, Sam. So this week on the Antifada, we have a nice chat with our friends at Swampside Chats about Star Trek. We watched a two-part episode, so it is itself a two-part episode called Past Tense, where the crew goes back in time to a San Francisco homeless camp at the time of a riot against neoliberalism, which then spiraled into international revolution, bringing us the space communism that we know and love about the normal timeline of Star Trek. So it's written in the 90s, and it really predicts a lot of the economic crises of the current day, rounding up homeless people into camps, and you know, maybe the coming revolution. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Check it out. And also, Sean and I will be recording a new, very topical episode this weekend. So look out for that next week.
Okay, great. And Matt, what happened on TMBS this week?
Yeah, we had Matt Karp come in to talk about Bernie 2020 and what we learned from it and how we can follow in the radical Republicans' footsteps against the Supreme Court. And also Luke Mayville on that Reclaim ID Medicaid expansion program in Idaho. So big show on Tuesday, patreon.com/TMBS.
And old Matt will be joining us in the fun half. But in the meantime, what's going on Doomed these days, Matt?
Oh, well, hey, Sam. Yeah, I got the Majority Report backdrop going. I do this every week. Nice to see that you
No, I know. Watch. But I mean, how? Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. So, do you have a green screen up? Is that it?
I do have a green screen behind me, yeah.
Because that looks super solid.
Yeah, it's a green screen, and then I basically use the program I use to like, I use a virtual mic in this program, Ecamm Live, which I use to stream, and that replaces the green screen with this photo I took the last time I was at the office of the Majority Report backdrop.
Oh, so that's not via Zoom?
No, it's not. I mean, I'm through Zoom, but the green screen's being done in another program.
Interesting. That's why it's probably a little more solid than mine. I did that last night for the debate, and it doesn't look as good as yours.
Yeah, I saw. It didn't. Anyway, youtube.com/Matt Binder tonight at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. I will have Parker Malloy of Media Matters on the show, and we'll be breaking down Trump's misadventures with COVID this past week.
There you go. All right. We'll head into the fun half. I will be back tomorrow and leave you guys in the to have at it. There's a lot of fly footage, I guess, that still has yet to be played. All right, folks. See you tomorrow.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.